Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. And this edition is made in partnership with Anglo-American. Today, we're looking into the extraordinary, vibrant world of the rhizosphere. Now, depending on where your expertise lies, you may or may not know exactly what I'm talking about. The rhizosphere is a narrow region of soil that is vital to the health of crops and the land itself. A healthy rhizosphere is teeming with a diverse range of microorganisms, and taking care of it is anything but simple. In fact, there's a whole lot we don't know about it, or about the way those microorganisms interact with the soil and crops. But that's part of what makes it so fascinating. And we do know that gaining a greater understanding is crucial to the future of farming. I can also tell you that there are few people who know as much about the rhizosphere as today's guest. I'm delighted to welcome to the podcast Catherine Bartlett, a soil scientist at Anglo-American Crop Nutrients. Hello there, Catherine.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me today.
Ah, it's such a delight. Well, look, I've had a very brief pop at describing the rhizosphere, but you're the expert. In a few sentences, well, as many sentences as you fancy, really, can you give us a clear explanation of what it is?
Well, first of all, I'll say that you gave a really good introduction to what the rhizosphere is.
Oh, very good.
But I think one of the things that makes the rhizosphere interesting is that, unlike many other things that we quantify, it doesn't really have a definition by size or shape. In fact, it's rather more a gradient in terms of sort of chemical and biological and physical properties that change both radially and longitudinally with the root of a plant. And so if you imagine in three dimensions, that's actually quite a complicated idea to think about, because we can't say, well, it's 10 centimetres either side of a root, or it's 3 millimetres either side of a root. In fact, it really depends on the rooting structure of the plant, and also then the chemical properties within the soil and physical properties within the soil to create what in fact is the rhizosphere. I like to think of it a certain way. So I like to think of microbes in the soil in general, like we think about a country or a region. So we have pockets of little villages and houses, and this is like the bulk soil. So there's areas where there's sort of a microbial desert, if you like, and then there's areas of little villages or slightly bigger towns in the soil. If you imagine it like that, then the rhizosphere is a metropolis. It's the city. It's the living, breathing, cultural, diverse, active part of the microbial community. It's where it's at. It's the London to some very small village on the outside. It's just where it's all happening. It is the most dynamic part of the soil in terms of microbial life. The other thing to think about is that we have this adage in soil science where we say a teaspoon of soil contains a bigger diversity than there are people on the entire planet. And I'm sure you've heard it in various different ways. When we think about the rhizosphere, that diversity can be 1,000 or 2,000 times more. Now, that's just staggering. The numbers that we're talking about here are so large that it's almost impossible for the human mind to really grasp that as a concept. So not only do we have this fantastical world that's like this great big city that transports nutrients from one part of the soil to the plant, and the plant has this wonderful way of interacting with the soil that it can select its own rhizosphere. You know, plants signal to microorganisms in the soil. They say, hey, come over here, I've got something really great for you. And they create this environment, and then in turn, the microbes create another environment. And it's this wonderful sort of mutualistic, symbiotic, sometimes pathogenic place. So it's so dynamic, and there's so much going on that it really is quite staggering to consider. And in the same way as cities are exciting and vibrant places, I like to imagine the rhizosphere as this dynamic and exciting place to be, where civilizations rise and fall in hours, you know, in minutes. And you have this wonderful interplay between chemistry and biology and physics, because it's all happening not only three-dimensionally, but it's all happening in terms of chemical gradients. All of these things impact. So you've got physical interaction with a biological interaction, and all of these things interplay with each other. It makes it fantastically complicated to look at. It makes it fantastically interesting, because what better than an almost unsolvable problem for scientists?
Well, you got me hooked already. Yeah, absolutely.
We love to ask more, though, as scientists, and I think that's something that makes microbiology particularly quite special. But also in soils, it has this wonderful three-dimensional context that just we don't see in, say, medical microbiology. I'm sorry to say, in quite the same way.
Put the cat amongst the pigeons. Before we carry on, so the rhizo part, what does rhizo mean? Is that about roots?
Yeah, so sorry, I should have gone back. I think it's early 1800s that it was officially termed the rhizosphere. And yeah, that comes from, I believe, the Greek for root.
Okay, so why is it such an important area? What role does it play, the rhizosphere?
So the rhizosphere in the soil is where you have the largest amount of nutrient exchange between a plant and the soil. And so we have, I suppose I should really say that the rhizosphere is split into arguably three different sort of zones. We have the endorhizosphere, which is actually within the plant root. We have the rhizoplane, which is sort of the epidermis, if you like, of the root. It's that line between arguably inside and outside the root. And then we have the ectorhizosphere, which is the soil surrounding the root. And so obviously there's then a gradient of life, if you like, going away from the root that's associated with that. In terms of activity and diversity, the largest part of that that's in terms of community is the point of the epidermis. It's where the soil meets the root. There is where you find the biggest interaction, the biggest diversity. But you have different species of microorganism that interact in different parts of the rhizosphere, and they offer different functions. So if we think about the conversion of nutrients, for example, in the soil, many of the nutrients in soil are not necessarily plant available. That is to say that they're not in a format that the plants can absorb on their own. And in order to make that happen, they need a microbial process. Just about all of the nutrients in soil require some kind of processing by microbial life. Be that fungal, be that bacterial, there is a function there within the soil to allow a nutrient to become available to a crop plant. The other interesting thing, I think, about the rhizosphere, and I'm no plant biologist by any stretch of the imagination, but the rhizosphere is intrinsically linked to the plant. That's to say that a corn plant will generate a different rhizosphere to a wheat plant, or to a legume, or to whatever kind of plant, whether we're talking about a monocot grass or whether we're talking about a dicotyledon plant. Those interactions are different, and they create a different community straight away. And as I said previously, the idea that you plant your plant in its soil, and the plant then essentially calls out to the microbes in that soil to select its own rhizosphere, to select its own microbial help in order to get the best out of that soil. But equally, what happens when we put our plant into a soil where it wants a certain type of microbe and it isn't available, or it's less available? And I think this is the challenge for the future in terms of looking at land management and looking at how we can better utilize what we know from soil microbiology. And how we can then impact future, let's say, fertilization regimes or land, general holistic land management approaches, is gaining a better understanding of this interaction between the microbe selecting and the plant selecting, and what those physical parameters are. You know, whether there's things like aluminium in the soil, there are certain processes in microbes that can reduce aluminium toxicity, for example, to the plant. Now, fascinating for us to know, and it's fantastic for yield and cropping when we're thinking about feeding a growing population in the world. So we can think about certain aspects of the rhizosphere as, if you like, biofertilizers, because they're providing these nutrients for the plant and essentially selecting the best possible growing environment for that plant from the resources available. So we know, for example, there's identified species that would convert atmospheric nitrogen to a form that the plant can use. All of these processes are really interesting and really open up a world of possibility. And we're not there yet exactly, but it gives us an insight into where science may go in terms of reducing the amount of ammonium nitrate that we use, for example, in farm and cropping systems, and reducing our inputs or changing the way that we apply those inputs so that, in fact, we are using the best possible resources available to create the best possible environment. Because ultimately, in a agricultural system, certainly, what we're looking for is the best possible outcome. The best possible outcome is generally yield and quality. And yield and quality are achieved by nutrient availability. So it is a very difficult world to pin down, because we can look at it from all of these very different viewpoints. And I think one of the challenges going forward in the world of soil microbiology and in terms of understanding better how the rhizosphere functions is really being able to bring all of those different expertises around a table, because you need the plant biologists, you need the agronomists, you need the soil scientists. You know, we need people with good chemical, physical, biological understanding to bring all of these processes together in order to develop new technologies or new ways of managing land for whatever the outcome is that we expect. Because we don't just get yield and better crop quality, but we also get other environmental benefits from the rhizosphere and the soil microbiology in general. So we have things like better soil structure. We have better water holding capacity, less flooding, less soil particulates leaving the soil body, i.e. ending up in your river and silting up the rivers, causing problems further downstream. Also have potentially less pollutants, because a lot of pollutants, for example, phosphates in soil, are bound onto to particles in the soil. So if you lose the soil from the field, you lose the pollutant at the same time, and again causes problems further downstream and into the rest of the ecology of the area. So there are lots of things here that interconnect, and it starts off really small with this plant root microbial interaction, which is tiny, but yet it has this huge butterfly effect that later on we see massive environmental damage or massive environmental benefit to how we manage that system at that very tiny, tiny level. And that can only be fascinating. How can that not be interesting to anybody?
Absolutely.
To think that something so tiny can impact the amount of flooding you get in a region.
And the complexity of this is extraordinary. So talking about the idea of an endorhizosphere in the root of the plant is quite a mind-blowing idea. But you also mentioned the concept of, you know, you mentioned several times that we want to understand better about how to do these things, which begs the question, because the complexity of these things are so immense and the codependencies between different aspects of it are so immense, how much do we know and how much don't we know? How much do we know about it, about how it works, and how to manage it? Or are we just basically scraping the surface at the moment?
Well, that's a really good question. Are we just scraping the surface? Well, we do know quite a lot. I mean, if we put this into context, microbiology in the world of science is relatively young. So I think we go into roughly the mid-1600s for when the first person looked down a microscope and saw microbial life in any...
The animalcules.
In any context, exactly. Whereas when we think about sort of the philosophy of science and sort of the greater or the more original sciences, we go back to BCE, you know, we're talking 2000, BCE, I mean, it's an incredible amount of time difference here. So we've got a relatively young science and therefore relatively young techniques for being able to describe and understand that world. Then we add to that the complexity of soil, which is never a wonderful media to work with if you're trying to limit your variables. And it's the joy and the pain that we have as soil scientists. But if we add into that the fact that we've had relatively less time to study these processes, I think we've probably done a reasonably good job of understanding and defining. But as with everything in science, there's always a progress that's happening daily. New information is understood, new techniques are developed, new ways of looking at things. And so that every time we develop a new technique or we think about a new theory and relate it into this, then it opens up the door a little bit wider, I suppose. And so as scientists, we're never finished, really. And so we will always say, there's more to know and we need to know more.
we call for more research.
It's exactly, it's the adage of all the research proposals ever written, is that, you know, we always need more research. But that said, I think one of the difficulties we have is that if we think about, I apologize for going back to sort of bulk soil microbiology, but if we think about larger scale soil microbiology just for a second, we can probably culture to visibly see maybe 10% of the bacteria and microorganisms that exist in that soil. I mean, that's phenomenal, right? That's like saying, you know, we'll take 10% of the population of the Earth and we'll say that's what it looks like and that's how it behaves based on 10%. So, you know, I don't know what that equates to in global population, what size of country that would be. But what I'm saying is that by our very techniques that we use, we are selecting what we look at. And that's always a problem. And as scientists, we like to scrape everything away and make it as simple a question as possible and to ask it in the simplest manner in order to reduce, you know, this horrible world of variability. You know, a very simple question and a very simple experimental design to answer that question. And here's the problem with the rhizosphere. It is so intrinsically connected to the plant and to the soil environment that whenever we try to disconnect all of those things, we immediately alter the situation that we're looking at. And so, for example, we can isolate, and we have better techniques now of viewing microorganisms in the soil with the advent of scanning electron microscopy. And there are a myriad of different ways that we look at microbial communities, be that through genetic mechanisms such as DNA or RNA sequencing, or whether it's through phospholipid fatty acid determinations. There's many different ways to look at the microbial community and to categorize it, shall we say, into functional groups, which is quite useful in the world of environmental microbiology. But we still, when we work on lab-related studies, for example, we still are selecting what we're looking at. And so we know how potentially, let's say, one fungal-plant interaction might happen, but we don't necessarily know how that really works if that's in a real living, breathing soil that has more than just that one type of fungus in it, for example. And so I think this is always the problem. And so we have to ask this question many times and experiment in many different ways in order to get to that answer, because we can scrape it right back and isolate that one fungus and plant it in a plant pot of sterilized soil with that one plant type that we're interested in. But then to extrapolate that up to a field or a region or a nation is very complicated, because at each level that we extend that experiment, we add more and more things that have an impact, a factor that has an impact on that result. So if you imagine just for a second that you change the soil type and only the soil type, you would instantly have a very different rhizosphere, because you've got a different pH, you've got a different chemical balance, you've got a different nutrient balance. All of these things are interacting. And so whilst I laugh at the idea of saying we need to do more research, we do, because it is fundamentally very difficult to pin down something which has so many interactions. But the more we do that, and the more we isolate species, and the more we understand about how these things interact, the better we are, and the more practical we can be about that and its use in land management particularly, because we are ever producing new and better ways of looking at data, for example.
Yeah.
You know, computer technology has come on massively and allows us to look at data in ways that we wouldn't have time to do longhand ever. And yet we produce this vast amount of data from, say, DNA sequencing, and it's very relatively quick to sort through that data now and to categorize that data. And all of these technologies added together equal better and better information and better understanding. And we can put more things together to create mechanisms of understanding. If you take that soil type and that crop type and this kind of bacterial fungal relationship, then, you know, maybe this is a better way of doing it, or that is a better way of doing it in terms of nutrient inputs into that specific landscape.
Yeah. So I mean, the obvious comparison here is with the human gut microbiome. And is that a useful analogy, or is that a distraction?
Oh,
is the rhizosphere agriculture's gut?
Oh, I suppose it is quite a good analogy. I can't say I've given it a great huge amount of thought, but if we think about recent links, for example, that have been made with things like dementia and the link to gut flora there, arguably we could say the same for the rhizosphere, in that we know that certain kinds of amendments create maybe a more bacterially high colony environment in the rhizosphere, or would have an impact on the amount of pathogenic fungi, for example, that you would see within the rhizosphere. So yes, it is a balanced system in that, well, we believe it's a balanced system in that you have all of these interplays going on all of the time. There's always an element of competition. There's always an element of mutualistic arrangement. And then we have symbiotic arrangement, which is a little bit more beneficial to one than the other. But ultimately, these relationships are going on all of the time, and they are very dynamic. And that's the fascinating thing in microbiology, right? Mm. In larger animals, we can't see this generational change. In certain forms of bacteria, that happens in hours, minutes even. And so you have the rise and fall of these civilizations in the blink of an eye, essentially.
So what things influence the health of the rhizosphere? What are the main factors?
Well, for a start, there is the quality of the air space in the soil. So if you have a better distribution of air, then you have a larger aerobic population of microbes. But obviously, if you have a large amount of water, so surface water in soils, for example, then you create an anaerobic environment. And many, many, many pathogenic species are associated with anaerobic environments for plants, but also for humans, incidentally. So there's your link back to your human microbiome. And so the physical nature of the soil, i.e. its structure in three dimensions, is important for the distribution of that microbial life, and then the availability of nutrients to that microbial life. But then notwithstanding the fact that the plant produces also nutrients for the microbes, which is how they call them in with their extracellular polysaccharides, for example.
I love this. This is just beautiful science. I love it. All fits together.
You know, these root cells that get sloughed off at the bottom of roots, for example, that provide this hugely nourishing world for the microbiome and the pulling that all in together and those interactions. But just taking a step back a little bit, one of the things that we can say in sort of more general biology is that the more diversity we have, the more resistance and resilience we have within that community. And so I think really when we think about managing the rhizosphere, we also have to keep in mind that if we have a good diversity of both the good, bad and the ugly, if you like, then we can manage that process better for better outcomes. And I think that's a much more productive way of looking at it, rather than potentially taking one species and saying this is the key to all of our crop nutrition needs, for example. Well, it may be helpful, but we also have to think about it in consideration of a much larger and much more diverse environment. That brings me back to my analogy as the rhizosphere being a city, in that if you imagine all of these nutrients arriving like trains into a central station, then if we take away some of those routes, then suddenly the plant and the microbes in that region are not going to function in the same way. You know, if you think about your commute on the way to work, if you're fortunate or unfortunate enough to work in London and you take the tube, you know, and all of a sudden one of the lines is broken or there's a problem with a line and it goes down, you have to think, okay, I can't take my usual route, I have to go a different way. And it's the same in the microbial world in terms of finding food, which is essentially the driving force for most life on Earth,
yeah,
really.
Absolutely.
And so going back to that sort of city analogy, I think it's quite useful because all of these things have this interplay and it gives a nice vision point in terms of how can we minimize our impact? Well, we minimize our impact by not completely removing an arm of the microbial community or, you know, or a whole branch line.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I think it's really about balance. And with crop nutrition, that's quite difficult because we have become dependent for our food production on a system that requires input because our soils in some cases are quite depleted. Or as the population increases, we use more and more what we would say marginal land, but maybe land that previously we wouldn't have thought of for agriculture because it's maybe not as fertile. But now we have very little choice. We have a population that requires a certain amount of food. And so these areas of land are brought into agriculture. And I think a better understanding of how all of these things pull together gives us a way of finding a more optimal nutrient usage.
Yeah.
That's to say that we look at the whole system rather than just one set of inputs. And I think it's also acknowledging that if we add inputs that have a pH difference to the soil that we're adding them to, then that again will change the environment that these microorganisms are living in, because we are altering the pH, we alter the availability of nutrients straight away to the microbial community, and that in turn has an impact on the plant, because the plant is suddenly no longer able to access these nutrients in the way it was before. And so we need to consider what the impact of each nutritional input that we make is. And sometimes it's not about one versus another. It's about finding a balance across several potentially. So looking at things like, for example, Poly4, which is an Anglo-American mineral fertilizer, has a neutral pH. So the addition of some of an amendment such as that is going to have a less radical chemical impact than another, which would have a different pH value. And so it would alter or acidify the soil in a different way. So it's about a balance. It's about finding the needs of that particular soil and plant, and also the human population, because this doesn't just work in terms of agricultural land. This works in terms of all land, of all soils, of all systems, including forestry systems, for example. So We have to think about it in terms of what is it we expect from that area. It becomes more than just we want yield and we want quality, but it becomes bigger questions like we want better water movement in our soil, or we want less flooding, or we want more carbon sequestration. All of these processes are in some way managed through this microbial world and through its interaction within the soil. So it isn't easy to unpick.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's why it's so fascinating as well. Okay, but so how could rhizosphere management help with sustainability, for instance?
Well, rhizosphere management can help with sustainability because, as mentioned earlier, some of the fractions of the microbial community in the rhizosphere are classed as biofertilizers. But you also have the creation of fungicidal elements by the microbial community in the rhizosphere. So there's also this amendment, if you like, of the balance. If the pathogenic species become too much, there are mechanisms within the rhizosphere to reduce numbers equally. And that's impossible to imagine, that essentially by tinkering here and there, we could create a community which looks after the pathogenic species that we don't want and influences the positive species that we do. And that is possible. And at the moment, the mechanisms for that at a field scale are quite difficult to imagine. But that's evidenced already in the laboratory in terms of how these things are studied, both in small scale, totally isolated situations, but also in slightly larger scale where we have more plant and more conditions in the experiment. So the idea of creating a product to suit one soil type and one crop type, you can almost imagine a future where we can be as exacting as that in terms of how we might manage the biology to create better these ecosystem services that we want. As I said, it's not necessarily just production. You know, there are wider ecosystem benefits. For example, carbon sequestration, which is, you know, very well known and is a microbial process in soils.
Yeah.
So fundamentally, we can start to manage for the function that we want. Then we have essentially a developed range of functional tools.
Okay, now can we talk a little bit about, I mean, we talked a lot about biochemistry, but can we talk a bit about fungi and the sort of the physics of this, the channels that they can create in the soil? Can you explain a bit more about that?
Yeah, the other amazing aspect of microbiology in soils is the ability for them to change their physical environment. So not only do you have the root exerting massive pressure in the soil to create the root going down into the soil, but you also then have fungal hyphae pushing through the soil and linking parts of the soil from one part of the soil body to another. So this is your railway in your city analogy. You know, this is moving nutrients, first and foremost, from one part of the soil to another part of the soil. They also store nutrients within their body, within the cell body itself. And so you're creating little channels of nutrients that may or may not become available to other microorganisms, depending on whether or not the fungi is overcome. But also that physical hyphae, that physical filament running through the soil, changes the structure. So we have an increase in structural stability, for example, in the soil, because you essentially knit it all together. I mean, I don't know how else to put it,
yeah.
Other than, you know, if you see soil that's got a lot of fungi and you can visibly see the mycelia in the soil, and you can see that kind of knitted together appearance. And so there is this great physical reaction going on here, which also, again, in turn, has an impact on things like the water movement through the soil. So you have these filaments running through the soil, but at some point when that cell degrades and dies, then you're left with a channel in the soil, and which provides things like preferential flow of water, for example, through the soil. And it continues a different form of life, essentially, because you're creating an area that previously was nutrient poor that's suddenly nutrient rich and also has availability to water. Well, you know, there's a massive driving force for microbial life. And so, yeah, the physical structure, but it's not just fungi that impact the physical structure. You have bacterial cells that secrete extracellular polysaccharides, and they stick the soil particles together and create things like better aggregation. Better aggregation improves soil water holding capacity. So then we have soils that are much more able to sponge up water and are less likely to release it directly into the wider environment. So absolutely there's this physical interaction and this physical almost soil building that happens within the microbial physical world. And because microbes in soil kind of, I said at the beginning that it's like a sort of desert, if you like, and there's lots of little pockets of life. So you also get this interplay between areas that are rich in life, if you like, and areas that are poor in life by comparison. And so the mutualistic relationships that are happening, those pathogenic relationships that are happening, and those symbiotic relationships that are happening happen also at different scales. And let's not forget, when we're talking about especially production systems, that these things happen temporally. They happen over time. Mm. So also the other real difficulty that we have is that often for example, our cropping happens on a yearly cycle. But within a rotation, you might have a 3 or 4 year cycle. And what are the impacts of your choices of land management over that time? Because the microbial community can shift quite quickly, but also we see a trend towards stability at a certain point. And so at which point do we say we've achieved sort of, I don't know how to put it, peak soil microbiology or peak microbiome for that particular crop in that particular situation. And so that's also a question that we can't necessarily answer quite so simply.
And what about the flip side of that? I mean, you know, when microbes can actually kill a plant because of the pathogenic relationships you mentioned. How big a problem is this? Is it a tangible problem in farming?
I think it's, yes. I mean, if you lose the entirety of your crop, that is, you know, an economical disaster for a farmer, for sure. And we can produce land management practices which select more for pathogenic species. But equally, when we add organic matter into soil, this is a good thing. It creates better diversity. It creates better structure of the soil and so on. And so there is very definitely a trade-off between the choices that we make and how we make those. And pathogenic species are well studied because when a crop dies, that's a big problem. And so we tend to have quite a lot of knowledge about the single species potentially that is the problem. But we don't necessarily understand the relationship between, if we have more of that in the soil, is it bad? Or if we have a better diversity, does that provide a mechanism to less pathogenic problems? Mm-hmm. In that there is higher competition in a more diverse system. And therefore, the fact that there are increased numbers of pathogenic species is less of a problem because you've got other species that are capable of dealing with them.
So diversity is always the key here.
I think so, yes. I strongly believe that if we can create systems which have multiple channels, shall we say, then we create systems which are resilient. And going forward in climate change terms, that has to be important because we cannot know always what's around the corner in terms of the weather changes, in terms of temperature changes. All of these things, and especially in the last couple of years, have been higher and higher on people's agenda because we suddenly see heat waves where we've never had that kind of temperatures before. And we see a change in crop where we're able to grow certain crops is migrating slightly in continental terms, because the temperatures have changed sufficiently so that we can go further north with some crops, for example. And all of these things impact both the microbiology, but also how we select that and how we might look at it going forward.
And so if we do get a better understanding of the rhizosphere, what are the opportunities in terms of commercial products? I mean, could we see your greater understanding of this leading to changes to the types of fertilizers being produced, for example?
I think so. And in some cases, we're already seeing that because there are a number of small startup style companies who are utilising technologies in the microbial sense to create products that will potentially increase nitrogen in soils, nitrogen availability, for example, or phosphorus availability in the soil. And those technologies will be key going forward because, again, it comes back to having more than one solution for a problem. Mm-hmm. In the past, we've been pushed to having if you like, fewer solutions to a problem because the problem itself is so big. When we look back at sort of the advent of synthetic fertilizers being pushed very heavily by post-war years, the need was for crop, the need was for yield to supply food to people. And so arguably, since that time, much of the sort of research has been more focused on that system because it was there and in existence. And sometimes we need a great challenge in order to think about how we might tackle a problem differently. So these challenges of climate change and these challenges, these new challenges, if you like, of yield problems and of the availability of food, I think will provide us with a mechanism for, and already are providing us with a mechanism for, looking deeper into the possibility, into different solutions, be that biological, chemical, and physical. But most importantly, I think it's taking a step back and using potentially an array of those to deliver the ecosystem services we want from that area. So be that crop yield or quality, or be that a natural environment, be that a tree species, the possibilities are endless in terms of ecosystem delivery in that sense. But I think it comes back to the right thing at the right time for the right situation. And we haven't previously necessarily looked at our fertilizer regime in agricultural systems in that way. And I think now there is a drive to do that, not just in terms of creating better soil health in general, but also in terms of economics for the farmer. When we see large spikes in fertilizer costs, that sets different drivers in place. But also, I think we have a community of land managers who are interested and who want to be involved in that journey and that process. And I think we have a structure and a way of looking at things now, which perhaps allows that relationship between the land manager, the scientists, and industry to work much better in harmony together to create solutions to the problem.
Beautifully put. Well, that was absolutely fascinating, and I love the idea of it being a city underground, and your analogies are fantastic. It does feel like we've only just scratched the soil surface of the rhizosphere anyway, so I suspect we're going to be talking more in the future, and I'd love to find out more as you discover more. So Catherine Bartlett, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this episode made in partnership with Anglo American. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. And remember, if you enjoy the Food Matters Live podcast, you can subscribe via your preferred platform. And if you feel inclined, why not leave us a review? Thank you so much for listening.